It was the biggest single campaign in the history of modern warfare. We found out later that the enemy had been told when it would happen, but not where. And it became the most extensively covered radio news story since the medium's invention. This was D-Day, the Allies' bold thrust onto the continent of Europe that began in the pre-dawn hours of June 6, 1944. It was the beginning of the end of the Second World War. Here at home, radio had supplanted newspaper as our primary source for breaking news. CBS, NBC, Mutual, and the new ABC network all had correspondents covering the fighting. It was a time when most news stories were reported live, often over unreliable shortwave relays, and almost all of the war news had to pass through military censors who carefully excised any information that might be helpful to the enemy.
American planes have carried out the greatest daylight operation of the war against unannounced targets in Germany.
By the summer of 1944, CBS and NBC had become the two preeminent news organizations. NBC had H.V. Kaltenborn, Walter Winchell, and John W. Vandercook, while William S. Paley's Columbia Network had Edward R. Murrow and his exceptional team of journalists, including Eric Severide, Charles Collingwood, Richard C. Hodelet, William L. Shirer, Larry Lesueur, and Robert Trout.
CBS World News, Bob Trout speaking. And again, we bring you the available...
As midnight approached on June 5th, Trout was stationed in Studio 9, the place where CBS had told the world about the Anschluss, Dunkirk, Pearl Harbor, and every other major story of the war. The Columbia shortwave listening station had intercepted a message from the German overseas DNB news agency announcing an attack in the vicinity of the Normandy Peninsula. Elmer Davis, an old CBS hand who now ran the War Department's public information office, was telling the press that he had no information on the German reports. Although the network normally shut down operations at midnight Eastern wartime, the decision was made to continue service until the reports could be authenticated. As 3 a.m. approached, Trout took over the microphone and began an impromptu tour of the New York newsroom, while engineers monitored the direct shortwave link to London, where the supreme headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces maintained a mysterious silence.
And now it might be a good idea to take you on a little 3 o'clock in the morning tour of Columbia's newsroom. So if you'll bear with me, I'm going to stand up from this table in the studio in which I've been broadcasting, open the door, take the microphone in my hand, and walk out into Columbia's newsroom, trailing the long cable behind me. And when we get out in our newsroom, we're now crossing the threshold, I'll read off to you some of the news machines and give you an idea just what they're printing at this hour of this unusual morning. Columbia's news staff has been quickly assembled, and so many staff members appeared so quickly that there are scarcely chairs enough for all members at once. Ned Kelmer, who finished his 11 o'clock broadcast about 4 hours ago, is still here. Major George Fielding Elliott hurried in, among others, and Major Elliott brought with him a very large supply of maps, as you can well imagine. In one of our offices, the radio is permanently tuned tonight to a London circuit so that we can hear whatever comes over on this particular circuit. A table has quickly been set up and now bears large cups of coffee, the inevitable accompaniment to all stories that break abruptly in the night. In some ways, the scene is not unlike those hard-working nights when the Germans were rushing through Denmark, Norway, the Low Countries, and France. But there's an awful lot of difference. Even though we're suspicious of this German story, and we think that the invasion very possibly has not begun, still the atmosphere in this newsroom tonight is far different from that on those anxious nights when the Germans were on the offensive. And now I've walked with the microphone down to the end of our newsroom, and the first machine that we come to is the Brown teletype printer, which turns out the reports from Reuters. That's the British news agency. And here's what Reuters has just printed. London, Reuters. An officer of the staff of the Allied Supreme Command of the Expeditionary Force today broadcast a warning specially addressed to all Frenchmen living at least within 35 kilometers of the coast. He said, the lives of many depend upon the speed with which you act. And then there was a brief pause, then Reuters continued, warning two, quote, the air war has entered upon a new phase. This, of course, is what the spokesman said. The air war has entered upon a new phase. You will be warned an hour before an attack. Leaflets will be dropped by Allied planes. As soon as you get the warning, go to your domicile and go at least 2 kilometers from it into the open country. 2, take along only what you can easily carry. 3, keep off all roads, railway lines, and bridges. 4, do not form groups which could be mistaken for troop concentrations. That's what Reuters is printing at the moment, and as all newsmen will recognize, the inevitable little postscript, the machine says, correction, and warning 2, read it, carry. Paragraph 3, keep off all roads. Next is the machine of the International News Service, and it has just been printing a dispatch from London by Kingsbury Smith. It says, Bulletin by Kingsbury Smith, International News Service Staff Correspondent, London, May 6, INS. German sources reported today that the Allies had launched the long-awaited invasion of the continent by landing parachutists in northern France and assaulting the French coast from the air and by sea. There was absolutely no immediate confirmation that the invasion had started, either from headquarters of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Allied Supreme Commander in the European theater, or any other Allied quarter. And then the bulletin from Smith goes on to say, Londoners and observers on the southeast coast of England said that wave upon wave of Allied air fleets constituting the largest force of bombers and fighters ever seen crossing the English Channel had gone out toward the French coast. Now, if you'll bear with me on this tour of the newsroom, instead of going along in the geographical way I ordinarily would go to the United
States
machine...
Then, at 3:27 Eastern wartime, the shortwave circuit crackled to life and Trout was given the cue to switch to London.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, for a special announcement from the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces from London, from Colonel R. Ernest Dupuis. Go ahead, London.
This is Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force. The text of communique number 1 will be released to the press and radio of the United Nations in 10 seconds. Repeat. 10 seconds from now. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. The communique will be repeated. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. This ends the reading of communique number 1 from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
This means invasion. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are back at Columbia's news headquarters, the newsroom in New York. I've just taken the microphone out of the studio again and back into our news headquarters. You have just heard from London, Colonel R. Ernest Dupuis of the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces reading communique number 1. Everything to this point has been German reports, and communique number 1 now says, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
That was the announcement. No details and no questions from the press. But for the rest of the night and into the next morning, listeners did get a glimpse of D-Day preparations and a picture of the first moments of the landing, including a riveting report from Columbia's Richard C. Hodlett.
And now for the report of Richard Hodlett of CBS. Go ahead, London.
This is Richard C. Hodlett speaking from London. The Allied forces landed in France early this morning. I watched the first landing barges hit the beach exactly on the minute of H hour. I was in a 9th Air Force Marauder flying at 4,500 feet along 20 miles of the invasion coast. From what I could see during those first few minutes, there was nothing stopping the assault parties from getting ashore. We spent about half an hour over enemy territory. We flew over and bombed some of the coastal fortifications. But except for some light flak from inland positions and from some tanks firing at us, we saw no enemy gunfire. The only other sign of life in enemy territory were some white and yellow parachutes dotting the ground where our paratroopers had hit the ground. The weather is favorable for the operation. Offshore Allied warships were bombing the enemy coast, and they seemed to be doing it without any opposition. As far as we were concerned, there was no opposition from the air either. The Luftwaffe just didn't seem to be there. What I saw was literally the last minute of the invasion preparation and the first minute of invasion. We were low, but we were traveling fast, and we could not tell how the battle for the beaches would develop. But if the ground action goes as smoothly as the air preparation, we can hope for the best. I went in with a bomber group, probably the hottest group in the 9th Air Force. Our mission was to plaster the invasion beach and some coastal fortifications with bombs 7 minutes before our assault parties came ashore. This group was chosen for the hair trigger work because of its previous superb record. Well, we delivered, and we delivered on time. This is the way it worked. Last night, we were told briefing would be at 3 o'clock. We got up at 2, had griddle cakes and fried Spam for breakfast, went into the long Nissen hut that serves as briefing room. The doors were closed, and the commanding officer announced that the invasion had begun. He said that since midnight, 3 hours before our paratroopers, some 20,000 of them had been landing in France. The men cheered. The colonel went on to say that the air forces were being called upon for their maximum contribution. There were going to be more than 1,500 fortresses and liberators flying ahead of us. Hundreds of medium bombers, too, were going to precede us. And our group was to wind up the pre-invasion bombing. When he said this, the men really cheered. To top it off, we were going to have cover from more than 2,500 Allied fighters. The colonel made it plain that nothing was to be left to chance. The weather in the target area had been unsettled and cloudy, and if we were going to deliver precision bombing, we would have to fly below the cloud. And that we would go down and bomb from 1,000 feet. When he said that, not a man blinked an eye, despite the fact that such a low altitude counts as suicide with the marauders. It was still dark when we took off and raining, but one by one, those marauders roared down the runway and took off. An hour and a half later, we were out over the English Channel. First, we couldn't see anything except a few stray vessels. Great care had been taken to keep our ships from firing at their own planes. Every single bomber and fighter had been painted overnight with special markings on wings and fuselage. And the direction we were to fly, the way we were to turn if we got into trouble, and the recognition signals we were to give had all been very carefully worked out. Even so, when we passed over the first few barges, we had the uncomfortable feeling that we were being shot at. It didn't last long. We were out and away in a matter of minutes. By this time, it was getting on, and the sun was painting the sky a bright orange color on our left. Below us, the English Channel was a fine, deep blue. There were a few white caps, but we got the impression that it wasn't very rough down below. About 5 miles off the French coast, we saw a plane in a steep dive laying a smokescreen. Just about the same minute, a pilot said he saw fires on the shore. I looked as hard as I could, and there, down to the left, were some naval vessels. They looked like cruisers, firing broadsides onto the shore. Their guns belched, flame and smoke. Once I saw a fountain of water not far from one of them, which may have been a shot from the shore or a depth charge. Near the cruisers were dozens of landing craft of all kinds, hardly visible in the early morning haze. All this while, we saw medium bombers and fighters crisscrossing on the way to the target without a sign of a German plane. Then, as we turned in over the coast about 10 minutes before H hour, we saw a fast assault boat race along parallel to the beach, laying a smoke screen. From the way the screen lay, smooth and even, it looked as if there were no wind. We opened our bomb bay doors. Light flak began to come up after us, little balls of fire off to our right and to our left. Some heavy flak off to our left, not near at all, firing only sporadically. The flights ahead of us dropped their bombs. The guns on the ships offshore resumed fire. The bombs and the shells burst together on the target. There were sheets of flame down below, then rolling balls of brown and black smoke. 4,500 feet up, our plane was rocked by the concussion. We got the stench of the explosives. We dropped our bombs as scheduled. Just then we saw down below on our left dozens and scores of white streaks as the assault boats raced over the blue water to the beach, leaving their white wakes stretched out behind them. As we turned away from the target, we saw the boats hit the beach. Then we took evasive action and I couldn't see any more. Down below, except for some more sporadic flak, it was a dead country. No sign of life. No vehicles on roads, no troop movements. And all the way in, we saw our marauders weaving in and out in perfect formation above us, below us, and around us on all sides. We didn't see a single one of our planes in distress. The mission wasn't the way we had figured it. We had expected to see German fortifications give back blow for blow with our ships. There was no sign of it. We had expected to see the Luftwaffe out in its full remaining strength to try to stop our planes, or at least strike a blow against our landing craft. We didn't see either. We had expected to find enemy territory full of anti-aircraft and alive with reserves moving into threatened areas. We didn't see that. The circumstances of our flight, the fact that we got there simultaneously with the invading troops and left in a minute, make it impossible to draw any far-reaching conclusions on how the battle is going. But one thing we can say already, and that is that our air supremacy over the coastal invasion zone today is not seriously challenged. I return you now to the United States.
For the rest of the night and well into the next day, Robert Trout choreographed the CBS coverage of this historic event. The BBC was the clearinghouse for overseas news sent via shortwave to the CBS listening post in New York, and Trout had to backtime his comments to seamlessly link with the feed content. It was a fundamental skill that became part of the lexicon of every notable and would-be news anchor from then on. While many colorful word pictures were painted, the graphic depiction of Allied losses that became a daily television diet during the Vietnam era was notably absent, the only allusion being the official line that casualties were lower than expected. Fast forward with us now to August 14, 1945. By now, Germany had surrendered, and atomic bombs had devastated Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. It was nearly 2 in the morning Eastern wartime, and on the Mutual Network, Cab Calloway and his orchestra are broadcasting from the New Zanzibar in New York City.
From the Mutual Newsroom in New York, San Francisco, the International News Service, FCC quotes, Domai saying Japan accepts Allied terms. Repeating this bulletin, dated San Francisco, the Federal Communication Commission quotes Domai saying Japan accepts Allied terms. This is not official. I repeat, this is not official. This is from the Tokyo radio.
And later that day,
7 p.m. Eastern wartime, Bob Trout reporting. The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That's the word we've just received from the White House in Washington. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War. The United Nations, on land, on the sea, in the air, and to the four corners of the earth, are united and are victorious. We got that information on a special line from the White House, and now it's beginning to come in on the wire services, too. President Truman announced it at 7 p.m. tonight, just a minute ago, and now a flash, MacArthur appointed Jap boss over the Emperor of Japan.
Robert Trout would continue to report the news for CBS and ABC for the next 40 years. Even after his retirement in 1996, at the age of 87, he would continue to be a fixture on National Public Radio, providing commentary and analysis until his death in the year 2000. His career spanned 7 decades, and all things considered, producer John McDonough spoke for many of us when he defined Trout as the last remaining link to the beginning of broadcast journalism. For the Keener Podcast, I'm Scott Westerman.